I'm very happy to be here. I'm very proud to be the new head coach for Brighton. For my football idea, it's very, very important to attack with many players.
Hello there, welcome. Welcome back to the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Ali Maxwell. On this week's episode, we'd like to talk about the Premier League's newest manager, and that is Roberto De Zerbi, who takes over from Graham Potter at fourth-placed Brighton & Hove Albion. He is a great topic for us, someone whose tactical approach at Sassuolo and Shakhtar Donetsk caught the eye of football tactics enthusiasts, dare I say it, many of you listening, and perhaps, like Potterball, it has its own moniker, De Zerbismo. So, I'm joined with two very well-placed experts to discuss De Zerbi. James Horncastle is back on the pod. Hello, James.
Good to be back.
Yeah, it's great to have you. How are you?
Yeah, great. Obviously been quite busy with this story. Premier League never sleeps in some respects, and certainly the cross-pollination between Serie A and English football continues apace. So, excited to see what Roberto brings in his first season in England.
Busy with this and busy covering Serie A in general, I dare say, because, to start the season, we have 5 points between seven teams at the top of the table. Juventus in eighth place and or in turmoil, depending on how seriously you take that. It feels, from a neutral's perspective, or rather a sort of ignorant observer's perspective, to have been a pretty fascinating start to the Serie A season.
Yeah, it's picked up really where it left off last year. If we zoom out a little bit, there have been three different winners in Serie A in the last three seasons. Okay, it's the big three. It's Juventus under Sarri, Inter under Conte, and Milan under Pioli. But, I wrote about this on the site this week. It's not beyond the realm of possibility that we have a fourth different winner, because Juventus and Inter, as you mentioned, feel like they are in turmoil. And whenever there's dysfunction and inefficiency at the big clubs, it allows someone else to steal in. And I think that's what Milan did last year. They were worthy winners, but very few people expected them to win the league last year. And you wonder if maybe Napoli and even Atalanta can do the same this year.
Well, joining James and myself is Liam Tharm. Liam, you are obsessed with tactics. Those are your words, not mine. You're also a Brighton fan and a former employee of the club. So certainly falling under the umbrella of well-placed for this week's topic. Are you excited about the appointment of De Zerbi off the back of what must have been a disappointing departure of former manager Graham Potter to Chelsea?
Yeah, I'm really excited. The club, in terms of sort of Tony Bloom, the chairman, and Paul Barber, the CEO, they've spoken about sort of now going through this period where we've had that sort of style transition, and we're now trying to consolidate and sustain. And I think a real good sort of marker for it is the club have been very open about wanting to be a top 10 Premier League team and sustain that. So I think for sort of setting our standards of where we want to be, this looks like a really, really, really fun appointment.
James, what was your initial reaction to hearing that Brighton first were interested in talking to Roberto De Zerbi and then choosing him as their man going forward? What's your instinct, knowing a lot about De Zerbi and about Brighton, the Premier League as well?
Excited. Because I've followed his career, over the last decade, really, from the beginning. And he had to start at the kind of bottom of the football pyramid because he didn't have the playing career that would get him a top job early. So, for example, you see Pirlo getting the Juventus job as his first opportunity. De Zerbi had to really start with Dat Fobbio, and then Foggia.
Are we talking, League Two equivalent, National League, what's the English football pyramid?
Certainly with Dat Fobbio, really at the bottom of the football pyramid. Foggia were in the third division at the time. And, Foggia itself, there's a romance about that club because it's always been a laboratory for wild attacking football. Back in the 90s, that was Zenit Zeman and his 4-3-3. They got promoted. They played really exciting football in Serie A, which was considered countercultural at the time. Zeman was a kind of fellow classmate of Arrigo Sacchi at Coverciano, which is Italy's kind of Ivy League coaching school. And they were both iconoclasts. They didn't want to play with the back three and the sweeper, and you know, look to basically play with a low block and counter attack. You know, they wanted to dominate the game, they wanted to take the game to their opponents, and they wanted to attack and keep attacking even when they were 1-0 up. And so, yeah, De Zerbi, even when he was at Foggia, you know, there were, you'll find YouTube clips of his football there, analysis of his football there. It was already attracting a lot of attention. And it was from there that he got the opportunity he did at Palermo, because there was a feeling that he was the, not next big thing, but certainly he was someone who was exciting and catching the eye. And Palermo were prepared to take chances on managers like that, just because the managerial job came up so often at Palermo, because Maurizio Zamperini, the former owner, used to sack managers every 3 weeks. And, you know, there's been some attention on De Zerbi having seven clubs in 5 years, or five clubs in 7 years. I can't remember which way around it is. I think it's that way. But, you know, the first job he took at Palermo was kind of a free hit, really, in that it doesn't matter how badly or how well you do, you know you're going to get sacked, just because the manager might not like the fact that you didn't call him after a game, or you didn't answer the phone when he was basically telling you to change your system or whatever. His other job in the top flight was with Benevento, and Benevento were dead and buried when he took over. It was just a chance for him, I think, to attempt to pull off Mission Impossible, but also show what he was capable of in the league, and did enough to get the Sassuolo job, which I think is where he became a little bit more mainstream than he had been up until now. So the prospect of seeing someone who is part of this new wave of Italian football, and as I said, countercultural from, you know, the traditions of Italy, is exciting, because I think De Zerbi very much falls into a category of players who came through at the time of Sacchi and Zeman, but also at a time when players were getting more exposure to leagues outside of Italy, and their reference points are Pep Guardiola, Bielsa, Quique Setién, rather than what had always been the case, which is Italians look within the league itself for their role models. They're often disciples of a Trapattoni, a Lippi. If it's not an Italian, it's a foreign manager who'd worked in the league, like Sven-Goran Eriksson. And so to see De Zerbi have the courage of his convictions and want to play this style, which has been quite polarizing in Italy, and we'll get to that, has been, yeah, it kind of makes this really fascinating.
Whenever we've spoken to you on this podcast, and often it's been about Italian managers and understanding where they've come from, I'm always struck by the fact that Italian football seems so much more, it seems to give young managers, and particularly managers who start in the third, fourth tier, much more scope for upward mobility to actually reach Serie A, whereas English football, it's very difficult to do that. I mean, Potter, I think, was the last manager hired into the Premier League from the EFL, and that was some years ago now. It's very, very rare. But also, you know, you talk about the fact that in terms of pure results, things haven't always been easy. It hasn't just been one straight upwards curve for De Zerbi. Does Italian football also have a better ability to sort of sift through different parts of management and understand better what makes a manager with potential to move upwards in terms of the pyramid, even if the results aren't the sole dictator of that?
I think there are a few things to consider from that. One is there's a lot of pride in Italy about their ability to educate coaches. That is why, if you look at the demographics of, you know, Italian coaching in Serie B, you know, for the most part, it is 80-90% Italians who are coaching. And if it's not, it's people like Ivan Juric, Sinisa Mihailovic, Thiago Motta, players who'd played in Italy for the most part of their careers. And, you know, it's been quite interesting following the reaction to De Zerbi getting the job at Brighton back in Italy, because, you know, one of the comments has been the Premier League is dominated by coaches who come from outside of England. And if you look at Italy, Serie A is dominated by local native coaches, and maybe Serie A needs to broaden its horizons. But at the same time, I would say that at a time when Serie A has lost competitiveness in Europe, because its big clubs have been dysfunctional, there's this wealth gap between them and the rest, it has continued to export really good coaches. You know, you only have to look at that statistic about the Premier League, which is the nationality that has won the most Premier League titles is Italy. And, you know, I think because there was always this higher and fire results-based mentality, it has meant that lots of Italian managers have got lots of opportunities early and that there is no stigma in getting sacked. You'll get another opportunity for the most part. And that has kind of helped. I think in De Zerbi's case, he got the perfect next step after Palermo and Benevento, which is Sassuolo. And, you know, Sassuolo is a small town club, you know, even a village club. It's still remarkable that this is, they've been in Serie A for a decade now. They've punched well above their weight, but there's no pressure, there's no expectation around Sassuolo. And it allows a manager to work in peace, to develop his ideas away from the bright lights, away from the scrutiny of the media. It allows players to develop as well. In a comfortable environment. And, you know, I mean, that's something that De Zerbi kind of said, like, these players really need to push themselves because we're not playing in front of sellout crowds. We've got, you know, we can't even sell out our own ground. So the players, they can be a bit casual. But I think that has enabled him to develop his own identity and realise it on the football pitch. And I think that's ultimately, you know, what's appealed to Shakhtar and subsequently Brighton.
Being able to show some of these ideas and principles at Shakhtar on the European stage will have been a big step for him.
James, I think one question Brighton fans and sort of Premier League centric fans will have is sort of about Italian football in general and how sort of, I know a league doesn't always have a set style, but there seems to be certain styles and leagues that are more dominant or more feasible. How comparable do you think they are, sort of the Premier League stylistically to sort of Serie A and the transfer that we might then see?
The Premier League has this opinion of itself as the most intense league in the world, you know, in terms of it's up and down, it's physical, not necessarily in that the players are bigger, harder, stronger than elsewhere, but in the kind of aerobic intensity of the Premier League. Yeah, I think in Italy, there are different degrees of intensity. I think Serie A has the opinion of itself as being the most tactically intense league in the world, where you have to take on a lot of information. You have to process a lot of information, and that challenges players in a different way. It's also intense. It's far more intense from a, I wouldn't say a pressure point of view, but if you're a Premier League player, even at the biggest clubs, and your team loses a game, you know that you can leave the stadium, and there's not going to be a group of ultras waiting for you, running their keys down your car. They're not going to be kind of outside your house. They're not going to be sending severed pigs' heads on your doorstep. So mentally,
you've obviously,
I think,
not met the Brighton and Hove Albion.
Yeah,
ultras,
I was going to say.
so mentally, Serie A is very intense. I think I still think football is football, and you see it when, you know, Italian coaches go to the Premier League. They have no problem adapting and enforcing their own style. Whether it's successful or not, it kind of depends on the circumstances they find themselves in, the personnel that they have, but, you know, you can see Conte is as successful in England as he is in Serie A, and likewise we've seen it with Mancini over the years. We've seen it with Carlo Ancelotti. So, but I think what will be interesting is, again, Italy, because it's kind of, I mean, this is one of the historical things. You know, you've got the Alps between it and Switzerland and France. You've got the Adriatic on one side, the Mediterranean on the other. It's always felt like it's quite insular. And so they talk about calcio italiano, Italian football, and they talk about calcio europeo, European football, as though Italy is not part of Europe, as though Italy is separate. But De Zerbi's kind of football in Italy, I would say, is considered calcio europeo. It's more in keeping, more in step with what you see in Germany, Spain and England. It's what Italian teams should play in order to be competitive in the Champions League, the Europa League and the Conference League. Although we've just seen Jose Mourinho's Roma win the Conference League playing with a low block and on the counter-attack. So, yeah, in terms of assimilating with the Premier League, I'm not sure. I don't think that would be a problem. I think one of the things, and we've seen this, for example, when AC Milan played Salzburg in the Champions League a couple of weeks ago. Salzburg obviously play Red Bull football, and they're probably at this moment in time a better exponent of it than RB Leipzig in terms of how intensively they press, how high they come for you. And the reality is that not a lot of teams in Italy are used to playing against that kind of intensity. And so it'll be a very interesting test of De Zerbi's ideas, particularly when it comes to how he really likes to invite teams into his own penalty area. He puts a lot of responsibility, a lot of trust in his goalkeeper and his centre-backs to play through that pressure. But ultimately, these players at Brighton will be used to playing at that intensity. They'll be used to having Man City press them, Chelsea press them. So in that respect, they'll already be up to speed. It'll be about whether they can execute the ideas that De Zerbi kind of is going to be demanding from them.
Has he shown with this, you know, let's touch on these principles, tactical principles in possession, particularly playing out from the back with the goalkeeper and the centre-backs? I mean, from what I've seen, De Zerbi has been on the extreme end of that, as that has become, you know, a very popular way of building up among the elite clubs in Europe. Has that always been the case, even when he was in the lower leagues? Has he become more dogmatic as time has gone on? Or even adaptable, and not those are the clips that we're going to see on social media that do the rounds because when they play through it looks amazing. But is he dogmatic on that front, or is he what you might call pragmatic or more adaptable?
I think one of the things that Brighton wanted to establish is he adaptable? Because Potter was, you know, Potter would adjust his game plan depending on how the opponent plays. And look, you know, De Zerbi, when it comes to his build up, you know, they will build up with two centre backs and four. So two plus four, two centre backs with the full backs and two midfield players if they're playing against a team that has a lone striker. They'll build up with a three and kind of a deep lying playmaker if they're coming up against two strikers. But I kind of think what Brighton wanted to establish is he going to go long if needed? I would say he's not going to go long if needed. He's going to double down. He will look to play through because he believes that inviting teams onto you and playing through them gives you advantages. It gives you the possibility to have numerical superiority further up the pitch. And, you know, he wants his team to not give the ball away even when they're numerically at a disadvantage. So if it's a 1v2 or a 2v3, he still wants them to try and play through that and not give the ball away. Yeah, you know, that was one of his principles that he put in his thesis when he was studying for his pro license at Coverciano. You know, three things. He wants the ball as much as possible. He never wants his players to get rid of it. Play in the opposition half as much as you can. And win the ball back as fast as you can. There's nothing kind of revolutionary about that. These are things we kind of hear that almost every manager, aspiring manager, wants to do these days. But, you know, I think it's really interesting when you look at the data, and I think Liam can get into this, is that over his kind of spell at Sassuolo, his team had more touches in their own penalty area progressively every year. And that is a trend you usually see in teams that are down the bottom of the table because their opponents come onto them, they force them back, and they're having to play in their own penalty area. But it was a choice from De Zerbi. It wasn't something they were forced into. And, you know, I'm really interested to see how Sanchez, you know, is able to do what Andrea Consigli did, the goalkeeper. I mean, no one thought that Andrea Consigli, the Sassuolo goalkeeper, was going to become this kind of, I wouldn't say he was a playmaker goalkeeper, a goalkeeper sweeper, but certainly he was asked to kind of read the game in such a way that there would never be a big gap between him and his centre-backs. And if that meant that the defensive line was very high, then he was often standing outside of his box. That he was willing to play with courage, with his feet, that, you know, and read the play as well. So I'm interested to see what Sanchez does there, and also the centre backs, because, I mean, again, Gianmarco Ferrari, you know, not someone you will be known to a lot of our listeners, but, you know, principal centre back at Sassuolo, you know, asked to want the ball at his feet, be quick about moving into open spaces, you know, which doesn't mean sort of defending wide open spaces, but when you've got the ball, carry the ball into them and play out. So I'm interested to see how Dunk and Webster deal with that, because I think as much as those guys play with the ball quite a lot already, it's going to be a more extreme version, I think, of what they've been used to.
Well, at least they haven't been, you know, a million miles away from it in the last few seasons under Potter. I mean, as you talked about them having more touches inside their own box year on year, I suspect a reason for that might have been teams denying or trying desperately not to press them too high because they know that would be after a while, you know that's just the trap that they want you to fall into. And so maybe having to be even more patient with it in order to draw them onto them. I mean, it would be fascinating to see how West Ham United, for example, who have no interest in pressing at the very top of the pitch, it will be interesting to see how they respond to a De Zerbi Brighton side when they take each other on. Out of possession, is there anything particularly specific patterns that we might see from De Zerbi's Brighton?
Just win the ball back as soon as possible, and when you're trying to do that, take your cues from what the intention of the opponent is, which is if the opponent is looking to bear down and go and score, do everything to disrupt and slow him down, stop him. If the opponent is looking to consolidate possession, then in that scenario, look to regroup, get organized and back into shape. So that's more or less the philosophy. But in Italy, they talk a lot about le marcature preventive, and that is it's when you're on the attack and when you're in the opposition half that you're set up in such a way that if you lose the ball, you are already well positioned to win the ball back, defend. And he was
putting fullbacks inverted quite early on, wasn't he? Which has become common practice, and part of the reasoning for that is basically to defend in transition a little easier.
Yeah, so he's obsessed with that, getting that absolutely right. And, you know, again, in terms of influence with Bielsa and Pep, you know, they believe that attacking is the best form of defence, because if you're high up the pitch, you're further away from your own goal. You know, again, you know, nothing particularly extraordinary, but yeah, he's very much off cut from that cloth rather than, yeah, I mean, it drives old school Italian managers mad. those who are now in the TV studio as pundits, because more often than not they're there to analyse when it goes wrong rather than it goes right, and they say, why aren't you hoofing it, Roberto? Why aren't you kicking it into the stands? What are you doing? And you know, he believes that this is the best way for your team to gain an advantage. So I think the last point on this, his whole ethos is he believes it's a holistic way of playing, in that if you play out from the back, it means you have to be technically good enough to play out from the back. So we're going to work with you to improve your technique, and that's going to make you a better player. If you play out from the back, it means you're taking responsibility, because you're taking a risk. To accept that risk and accept that responsibility. So that's going to make you more of a leader, more well-rounded as a person, not only as a player. And if you succeed doing this and play out from the back and cut through a team, you're going to feel really good about it. It's going to build your confidence. It's going to build your self-esteem. And overall, it's a net positive, because, you know, you're becoming a better player, you're becoming a better character, and you're winning. So, you know, that's why he thoroughly believes in what he does.
I was going to ask lastly, before we turn our attention to the Brighton squad and what he'll be met with, or what he has been met with as he takes his first few steps there, with the style, the approach, the principles, you've spoken a lot about why he does it and his strong beliefs it is the right way to play to win football matches. Is there an aesthetic aspect to this as well? Is there anything to do with the romance of football and playing in a certain way for the fans or aesthetically? Or is De Zerbi ultimately, you know, is this about function? Is this about winning football matches?
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't like to be kind of characterized as a philosopher, as a purist. But, you know, he believes that in this kind of holistic approach, which, if you take it beyond the players, if you're playing a style of football which is technical, which is skill-based, which is attacking, the players won't just enjoy playing it, the fans will enjoy watching it, and it'll create a really good environment that in itself should help build momentum and become self-fulfilling in delivering wins and maybe trophies. But, you know, I mentioned how polarizing his football is in Italy, because, you know, we had a culture war kind of start in his second season. It coincided with Massimiliano Allegri's last season at Juventus. And, you know, there was a former player who's kind of the closest equivalent to Gary Neville on Sky Italia, called Lele Adani. And Adani is very kind of pro-De Zerbi, believes that because it's in step with modern football trends, this is the route that Italian football needs to follow in order to progress and evolve. And so he talks about, you know, South American influences and how important they are, and how important it is to look at Bielsa and Pep for our reference points, not the Italian coaches of the past. I think this has led to this kind of perception of De Zerbi as being presumptuous, and that's rubbed some people the wrong way. You know, they say, what's this guy ever won? You know, he's only coached small teams apart from, you know, obviously when he got the offer to go to Shakhtar. Why does he have this profile? It feels disproportionate. But, you know, as you know, Leonardo DiCaprio says in Inception, you know, the most powerful thing in the world is an idea. And De Zerbi's ideas are, in some respects, more important, more influential than a trophy that has been won by a team that's played in such a way that's kind of forgettable. So he spends time with Pep. We've seen that. You know, when he was starting out his coaching career, he made the journey up to the Dolomites, where Bayern were in pre-season training camp, so he could watch Pep's Bayern train, learn from it. He was recently at the City football campus with some members of his staff. Yeah, I mean, I think it's quite interesting that he's, since leaving Shakhtar, he's looked to refresh his staff, modernise, update. So he's in step. He's brought people in who feels that can keep him current, can kind of reinforce his ideas. But yeah, you know, I mean, fundamentally, there is an aesthetic to it. And I think we have seen with, you know, Mancini's Italy and the success that they had, which is Italy winning in a way that they've never won before. And because they'd never won playing that way before, before Mancini did it, people thought Italy can't win that way. And so to see Italy win that way, it kind of validates De Zerbi's ideas and says that, you know, yeah, maybe we should be getting behind this guy, because, you know, he is proposing a style of football that could be successful for Italy. So yeah, he's a fascinating figure, really.
Liam, a style of play that seems out of step with the club that the manager is coaching, admired by Pep Guardiola very openly, questioned by some with things like, what has he won? Or he's only taken them from exposition to exposition. It's pretty reminiscent of Graham Potter.
Yeah, I think you could quite easily, well, we have seen, haven't we, those same things applied, which is a good thing to some degree. In the sense that there's obviously that match. I think Tony Bloom described it as having the right cultural and tactical fit, which seemed to sort of summarise that quite nicely. But I think there's also needs to be the consideration that this is now different task to what he had at Sassuolo and different to what Potter had when he came in at Brighton, that this style overhaul doesn't need to occur. It's a case now of, can you consolidate and sort of hold a team up there?
Do you think that Brighton and the sort of mystery, if you will, that surrounds Brighton is everyone knows Tony Bloom is a data-led genius, and that sometimes obscures how things actually get done at Brighton and Hove Albion. With your knowledge of the club and its decision-making, do you think, yes, this would have been heavily data-driven? You know, will they have some spectacular manager models that spit out long lists and short lists?
I'm intrigued, but to some degree, of course, data is very much sort of Bloom's expertise from his gambling sort of background. And I'd imagine he uses that to do a lot of the legwork in terms of sort of profiling managers or sort of keeping tabs, because I imagine he's a very busy man and can't be watching sort of 10 to 15 different games on a weekly basis of sort of different managers. But I think, as we've sort of covered here, and James is sort of very, very interestingly explained, and this has been fascinating to listen to, about sort of the tactical uniqueness and the identity that comes with it. And that was a real big point they made when they brought Potter in initially, was we want to change the style of play. So I imagine this would be as much a tactical appointment as it would be anything that sort of the data indicates.
Do you think that, from what you've heard James explain about De Zerbi's philosophies, his principles, do you think that Brighton as a club, as a fan base, as a squad, seem ready for that, in good shape for that, comparative to other, you know, clubs that De Zerbi could walk into?
Yeah, I'd like to hope so. I think his sort of Champions League experience is really, really massive, and that's not to sort of be underrated or sort of undervalued here at all. I know he spoke about having other options in sort of Italy when he could have stayed there, but chose to sort of take this step out, which I think is is really quite cool and really probably deserves a lot more praise for. That was one of the things that really Potter had as a big sort of string to his bow, was the fact that he went out to Sweden and sort of went abroad. So I think that's really important. And then sort of goes to further explain about the number of clubs he's had in recent years, which is a sort of weird stick to almost beat him with. I've seen from some that, you know, he's almost not stayed long enough, but I think that's perfectly fine when you sort of look at the success. And Paul Barber had a sort of a very good answer to that when he was sort of quizzed about it, saying that you look at what he's achieved at these clubs, he's done probably for the most part as good as he could have done, or sort of taking them to more success. And it's now a case of your job, I suppose, is different to what he's had previously in sort of Italy, and maybe more akin to sort of at Shakhtar. You've got more of the pieces sort of put together now. The squad is in the best place it's sort of ever been from a Brighton perspective. They've brought the average age down massively under sort of not just Potter's tenure, because this was Dan Ashworth as well. And of course, Graham Potter was not solely responsible for the transfers. And they've, within that, have brought in a lot of players now that are at international level. So one of the great points Andy Naylor made in sort of one of his pieces on this is that he's going to inherit a great squad, and it's probably a good time to come in, because the day of recording, he's got 10 days until we play Liverpool. But quite a few players are going to be missing because they'll be away sort of internationally. But that's also a product of being successful, right? In that you have good players, their national teams sort of want them to play. And you go back to sort of 2018 in our debut Premier League season, I think we had three players go to the World Cup, and you're looking at having sort of seven or eight now, all of which will be under 25, bar Leo Trossard, which is, I think, a real indicator of how we have sort of moved along as a club as well.
I just always laugh at the "this manager has never won anything" line, partly because there aren't that many trophies to go around, to be honest. And it's really hard to win them when there are teams like Juventus or Man City or PSG, whatever it might be. And also, no one's ever won a trophy until the moment that they lift their first trophy, at which point does whatever point you were trying to make just vanish and suddenly you turn. I remember it with people used to say it about Klopp before Liverpool won things. Now, of course, he had won the Bundesliga with Dortmund, but you would still hear the occasional, well, he's not as good at getting over the line and winning those trophies. He just suddenly. Yeah.
And also this whole notion of it's our league, it's different. And the reality is the Premier League, there's very little that's English about the Premier League. We've talked about the athleticism, the physical intensity. Yeah, that is something that distinguishes it. But the reality is most of the managers are foreign, most of the players are foreign, and they all come from other places. Football, yes, there are different accents on it, different interpretations and all that sort of thing, but it fundamentally is the same game.
Yeah, it's been pretty pliable, hasn't it, really, to those coming in from the outside. I mean, Liam asked about the sort of translation between Serie A and the Premier League, but Pep came from Barcelona and Bayern Munich. Klopp came from the Bundesliga. Conte, even Mourinho, you know, back in 2004, coming from Porto, go back to Wenger. It has been pretty pliable for elite managers, no matter where they are from or where they previously managed. Liam, just looking at the squad, the Brighton squad, we like to play a game of good news for, bad news for when a new manager comes in. In terms of this Brighton squad, for who is De Zerbi's appointment good news?
Probably most of the squad is a very short answer. We've spoken about how it's evolved and how the style massively suits them. I think in particular and right now, Alexis McAllister and Moises Caicedo is the two players really that have been in sort of a double pivot, if you like, akin to what James was saying about how they build up with sort of a back four with the two fullbacks and then those two deeper midfielders. Those two have been excellent doing that since Caicedo really has come into the Premier League, and that's also been part from Alexis McAllister being, I don't say retrained, but he's just dropped a bit deeper. He was sort of signed and viewed, at least by me anyway, I might have got this wrong, but more of sort of a number 10, is now someone that plays a bit deeper. I think it's sort of the number 5 role now that he plays in South America, they would describe it. So for those two in particular, I think they'll really suit the ball playing style, as will the central defenders. It might be bad news for one or two of them because we've played a three a hell of a lot sort of recently, and I know that from what I've looked at and researched, De Zerbi has had more success with a four that's sort of been the golden thread. Seeing how sort of tactically complete he is, I don't think he's tied to that entirely, but it wouldn't surprise me to see him maybe go with the sort of shape that's brought him success elsewhere. So maybe that means someone like Joel Veltman misses out. But as James is sort of touching on with Duncan Webster in particular, a really good carry of the ball, really good pass off both feet, Dunk maybe a bit better at playing those longer passes that don't quite seem to be so Deserbi-like. And again, with sort of Sanchez, as James was saying, it'd be interesting to watch him. An immensely good distance kicker in terms of he could almost land a ball on like a five pence somewhere in the opposition half, which has been more of a tactic where Brighton sort of built up short, sort of bait the press and then go long. So whether, you know, he completely removes that, we'll wait and see. So it's a case then, yeah, of seeing where, I suppose, the strengths of certain players fit in regards to then overhauling the style.
James, it's kind of understanding to focus on goalkeeper, centre-back and the defensive midfield players and focus on how good are you at holding onto the ball when the pressure's really on, and how well can you both keep it and progress it through tight spaces. But just at the top end of the pitch, I'm interested to know, across the teams that De Zerbi has coached, who tends to score his goals? What sort of players, what sort of areas on the pitch are the goal scorers? You know, I'm looking on his Transfermarkt page now. You've got four players across his career that have scored at a better than 1 in 3 rate. Pietro Jamelo, Domenico Berardi, Francesco Caputo, and Vincenzo Sarno. So is there a common thread there, or do goals come from all over with De Zerbi, like they did under Potter?
Depends on personnel. I mean, you get goals from centre-backs, from set-pieces, when Demiral was playing. But, I mean, the style of football gets the best out of skillful and technical players. And, you know, as much as we've focused on the goalkeeper and the centre-back so far, you know, some of the players who've really benefited from playing under De Zerbi, Manuel Locatelli. You know, Locatelli was kind of lost and disillusioned after breaking through at AC Milan, and De Zerbi recognised that he works best in a double pivot, and yeah, doesn't just want his midfielders to take the ball off the centre backs. He wants them to get between the lines as well. Wants them to pick up goals. But you know, I mean, another thing that really kind of boosted De Zerbi's profile was the fact that this tiny team all of a sudden was supplying more players to the national team than anybody else. And that was Berardi. It was Raspadori. So Berardi is, you know, someone who's an inverted winger, plays on the right, he's left-footed, and he would tend to be their main goal scorer. Raspadori is someone who can play across the forward line, played off the left last year, but he can play off a striker as well. And there was a staggering percentage of their goals that were scored from open play. Not a team dependent on set pieces, not really a team dependent on penalties. That's something we've seen boom in Serie A over the last few years with the introduction of VAR. But I think one of the interesting things with De Zerbi is he is, you know, one of his acolytes, one of his peers in Italy, Ivan Juric, at Torino, said, you know, one of the things I like about Roberto is he manages to convince the owners of whatever club he's working for to buy the players that he wants. And we've often seen take one player from an old club to his new club. You know, that was the case with the Brazilian centre-back Marlon. He went from Sassuolo to Shakhtar. It's, if you go further back, Filip Juricic, the kind of socks down number 10 who can play out wide. You know, he went from Benevento to Sassuolo as well. So I'm interested to see what input and how much he can influence recruitment at Brighton. He's very active when it comes to, and very specific when it comes to recommending players. Sassuolo, for example, Maxime Lopez, the kind of diminutive playmaker that they have in midfield, again, very specifically wanted by De Zerbi. And yeah, I suppose when you've got so many gifted technicians on your team, if your technique's that good, you can get goals from pretty much anybody. I think the final point on this is another thing that appealed to Brighton is he improves players, and when you improve players, they catch the eyes of other clubs. And I think he'll be, if he's successful and he's there for the mid to long term, there'll be other Cucurellas that they sell for big money, because, you know, that's something that he did really well at Sassuolo. They bought Stefano Sensi for 5 million, sold him for 25, Locatelli for 14, sold him for 40, Jeremy Boga for 10, sold him for 22, Demiral for 8, sold him for 20. So he's someone who, yeah, I think Moise Caicedo already has a lot of interest, but I think that interest will continue and will percolate even more with De Zerbi. And I think that's another aspect. You know, as much as people focus on Brighton data, I think they're very interested in kind of a coach's emotional intelligence, their ability to articulate what they want to a player, get them to buy in, and if they buy in, they will improve, and if they will improve, they'll get better, and if they get better, their value will go up, and boom.
Liam, there's so much that you have to bear in mind when hiring a manager, from what we think we know about Brighton and Hove Albion, from what we've heard about Roberto De Zerbi, it does seem like a very obvious fit, or at the very least, you can understand why what De Zerbi is offering attracted Brighton quite so much.
Yeah, for sure. I think the player development part is one of the most valuable and probably the most missed part quite easily. It's very easy to obviously sit there and pick apart the tactical side of things, and rightly so, but this is ultimately what Brighton's success has been underpinned on recently. It's been picking up players, recruiting well from different parts of the world. I'm sure if you looked at a map and sort of put a pin on every country, you'd cover sort of most of the globe. It's been quite frankly ridiculous. You go, just how do you find all these players? It's an alarmingly good hit rate. I had a look through Transfermarkt and saw he gave 24 Serie A debuts last at Sassuolo, and that was just to players age 23 or younger, which for like eight a season is, I can't imagine he's just, sort of handing these out to be tokens either. These are genuinely to integrate players into sort of a good style of play, and that's been really, really valuable. So to have that success and to do things tactically with a developing squad, I mean, I don't think we've mentioned it yet, but like this guy himself is quite a young manager. He's one of the youngest in the Premier League, and the average age is sort of dropping. I think it was over 50 sort of 4 or 5 years ago for managers. Now you're looking at quite a few being in the low to mid sort of 40s. So that, again, I doubt he's the complete version of himself yet. He's probably got a hell of a long way to go. And despite sort of still being young, he's had, a decade's worth of coaching experience at elite professional level, which I think just goes to show how good he must be to have been employed in those jobs early, and to try things, get things wrong. And it's probably a good time for Brighton now to have him, because he's gone through different projects in different clubs. He's more further along his journey than what, other managers might be, or say what Potter was sort of three years ago when we had him then.
For an ambitious manager, James, it's not just the opportunity to work in the Premier League, which, as we know, absolutely loves itself, but also to work for a club whose previous head coach was just appointed by Chelsea.
Yeah, that's it, Ali. And I think you kind of touched on a nerve there within Italy, because, again, some of the reaction to disappointment is, if you just hung around a little bit longer, I'm sure a big club would have come in for him in Italy. The reality is that being in the Premier League is huge for exposure, for challenging yourself. You mentioned Potter's kind of trajectory, but I mean, you can look at Pochettino as well. Poch comes in at Southampton, gets a Tottenham job, and frankly, it's where the best managers want to be. If you look at Conte right now, there isn't a club in Italy that has the budget that Tottenham has to kind of give him the possibility to shape a team, be competitive. And so in that respect, I think it makes a lot of sense. I just hope Potter, probably spoken in the past about his degrees in kind of emotional intelligence and all this sort of thing. Obviously, he's a native English speaker. He's able to communicate, articulate his ideas, get him across. I think that will be a challenge for De Zerbi. He spoke some English in the press conference. He would give stock answer in English and then lean on the interpreter. I think that's going to be really kind of crucial, not just in getting his message across, but making his players want to play for him and not be questioning, not be skeptical of him. So I hope it works out. There's always a risk whenever you make a managerial appointment. There's no, apart from Pep Guardiola or Jurgen Klopp, there's no real slam dunk guarantee on this. But I think for a person like De Zerbi at this stage of his career, the stability at Brighton, how they organise themselves and how they run, it does feel like the perfect stepping stone for him. So I just hope it works out for both of them, really.
De Zerbismo on the south coast of England. I was excited beforehand with little knowledge, even more so now that I've been armed with what's been imparted by James and Liam. Thank you so much, both. It's been an absolute pleasure. Make sure that you are reading James on Serie A on the Athletic site. Liam on all sorts of tactical goodness. Andy Naylor be a good one to subscribe to as well on the Athletic app to make sure you don't miss any Brighton news from this point. And of course, our normal regulars absent this week, Michael Cox and Mark Carey, still doing excellent work on there as well. If you're not a subscriber, become one today. Head to theathletic.com/tactics for everything you need on the world of football and American sports as well on the Athletic site and app. And we hope that you're subscribed to this podcast. And if you are, then you can join us again next week. Look forward to speaking to you then. Go well.
The Athletic.